KALW.
From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in East Oakland.
I live in Richmond.
Lake Merritt.
I live in North Oakland.
Berkeley.
Coming up, police have a suspect in the 40-year-old Golden State Killer case, but how they found him raises some privacy questions.
He was caught thanks to a combination of DNA and a free open source ancestry website.
Then we go to Grace Cathedral for a much anticipated service, Beyonce Mass.
How do women of color learn to love themselves in a culture that just doesn't always love them the way they actually deserve?
And we'll hear the real story behind a legendary San Franciscan.
All that African Americans knew was if they needed something, they would go to her and they would get it. And so they called her the Black City Hall.
That's all coming up today on Cross Currents. California has seen some notorious serial killers over the years. The Zodiac Killer, the Grim Sleeper, the Hillside Strangler. But the Golden State Killer might be the most terrifying. Beginning in the late 70s, he raped an estimated 50 women and killed at least 12 people throughout the state. Then the gruesome murders came to a halt in 1986. The killer vanished and the case went cold. Until now. Police arrested a suspect at his home in the Sacramento suburb last week. Now, we usually don't talk about serial killers here on Cross Currents, but the way this case was solved brings up some interesting questions about privacy and how police investigate rape cases. And joining me now to discuss this is KALW's justice reporter, Holly J. McDeed. So, Holly, after 40 plus years, Sacramento investigators believe they found the murderer. For people who did not live through this crime spree, tell us about it. What was it like?
So if you weren't there, it's hard to grasp how truly terrifying it was. Starting in 1976, there would be a new rape reported in the Sacramento area, sometimes weeks or even days apart, sometimes in the same neighborhood. The crimes were known to involve a man in a ski mask, breaking into homes during the night, tying up the husbands and raping the wives. Gun sales spiked. The Golden State Killer went on to rape and murder all over California. So people lived in fear, and some victims still do, and police just could not catch him.
So why did the police keep up the search for so long?
So over the years, a core group of people who called themselves citizen sleuths kept the pressure up. The most prominent was the late writer Michelle McNamara, who wrote I'll Be Gone in the Dark about the killer. McNamara pored over police reports, interviewed victims and family members, and chased details about the crime with other armchair detectives online until she died 2 years ago. She even gave the suspect his name, the Golden State Killer. So when they finally found him, even police admitted McNamara's best-selling book kept interest up and tips coming in.
Mm-hmm. So did police take the online detectives, these sleuths, did they take them seriously?
Well, it helped also that Sacramento's district attorney, Anne Marie Schubert, also really wanted to put this terrible mystery to rest. She grew up close to some of the crimes. She says her dad bought a firearm and her mother kept an ice pick under her pillow, scared they would be next. So 2 years ago, the DA successfully lobbied for a statewide task force to find the Golden State Killer. The FBI also launched a national pricey media campaign, hoping someone would come forward. People had always wondered if the killer lived in Sacramento amongst them. And there he was when they found him last week, living with his daughter and granddaughter in the sleepy Sacramento suburb of Citrus Heights. Now that police have arrested a suspect, some of the victims say they can finally sleep at night.
So tell us about the suspect that police arrested last week. Who is he?
His name is Joseph James D'Angelo. He's 72 years old. He served in the Navy during Vietnam. He was a police officer in the tiny Central Valley town of Exeter, then in Auburn, until he was fired there for shoplifting. Investigators believe he was still a cop when he began raping women. As for a motive, investigators say the East Area rapist once yelled, "I hate you, Bonnie, I hate you," while raping a victim. So police believe Bonnie is the rapist's ex-fiance and he committed the crimes seeking vengeance.
Oh, goodness. So how did he finally get caught? And what does all this have to do with privacy?
So he was caught thanks to a combination of DNA and a free open source ancestry website. Investigators used DNA from the crime scene and plugged the suspect's genetic profile into a free online gene database called GEDmatch. It's a kind of site people usually use when they want to learn more about their ancestors. So the search that led police to the killer's distant relative, and soon the pool of suspects eventually shrank to a single family. So police kind of wandered around the family tree, and keeping in mind what they knew about the suspect's age and his likely whereabouts, they were able to identify a suspect. They staked out his home and collected discarded items containing his DNA until they found their match.
So can law enforcement just go through and search through genealogy websites and get a hold of anyone's DNA?
Not always. Other sites like 23andMe and Ancestry.com require a court order for law enforcement to access DNA files stored in their databases. But GEDmatch doesn't have those kinds of privacy protections. So it's like once your brother or distant aunt uploads DNA online, police can trace genetic lines to you. You can't control what family members are putting up online. So this is kind of an unregulated world right now. And there can be false hits. In 2014, a search through a gene website led police working on a cold case to a man in New Orleans who turned out to be innocent.
Holly, what are some of the lessons from this case for law enforcement?
Some lawmakers are saying this case shows why we need to get DNA from all rape kits tested. So the Golden State Killer, he's never going to go to trial for the rapes he committed because the statute of limitations has expired. So in most rape cases, for that very reason, investigators usually throw out the DNA evidence. So after the suspect was found, people like Alameda County DA Nancy O'Malley said if this case doesn't prove that we should test every rape kit, no matter how old, then no other case will. It's also really personal for her. She remembers taking calls from women raped by the Golden State Killer while she was a volunteer with a rape crisis hotline. So now, decades later, the suspect is caught and she's championing a bill that's in the state Senate right now that would require California law enforcement agencies to test all rape kits. Right now, that testing is voluntary and some police agencies have said they don't have the resources to get through the backlog.
So as for this case, what happens now? What happens next?
So the suspect appeared in court for the first time on Friday. He was handcuffed in a wheelchair, his eyes barely open, and he did not enter a plea. Right now, the next court date is set for May 14th.
Holly is KALW's justice reporter. You can reach her at justice@KALW.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Last Wednesday, Grace Cathedral hosted an event that got national attention, a Beyoncé Mass. It might seem like an anomaly, but the Beyoncé Mass is just the latest in Grace Cathedral's non-traditional programming. It holds labyrinth walks and yoga classes for hundreds of people. Its Wednesday night program, The Vine, combines progressive readings of scripture with popular music, with special programs like a Sister Act Mass and a Bluegrass Mass that ran the same weekend as the Hardly Strictly Bluegrass Festival. The director of Innovative Ministry, Pastor Jude Harmon, says this programming hopes to show that God lives in places and music usually considered secular. I sat down with Pastor Harmon last week, and he told me the Beyoncé Mass came out of a desire to embrace people who don't always feel welcome at church, and to put front and center a practice called womanist theology, which interprets the Bible with an eye towards empowering women of color. Tell me about, well, who thought of this? When did you think of this, and why?
And so I really need to give basically all the credit to Professor Yolanda Norton. She is an amazing woman, a brilliant scholar and teacher. She is an assistant professor of of Old Testament at the San Francisco Theological Seminary, and she teaches a class called Beyonce in the Hebrew Bible.
Beyonce in the Hebrew Bible.
I mean, isn't that amazing? Don't you want to take that class?
It's a class.
I know, isn't that so cool? I wish I had classes like that in seminary. And Beyonce, like what she's actually doing in her music, she begins to really unpack some of these questions of agency and of redemption, of what it means to have hope in a world that is so broken and fragmented, frankly, by broken men. That's a very important piece of what she explores there. And also of a spiritual landscape that is so, that can be so toxic, frankly, for women of color.
So tell me about the Mass. What should people expect? What will happen? Is it Beyonce music blaring and people praying? Like
it's all Beyonce music, actually. Songs that I think deliberately push the boundary between the secular and the religious. Mm-hmm. There's that gorgeous song, Flaws and All. And, you know, when you hear those lyrics in the context of a church, it's like, well, who is she talking about? Is she talking about Jay-Z? Is she talking about God? Is she talking about someone else who affirms her in the midst of her own brokenness? I just think it's amazing that as an artist, she holds that brokenness with such love herself and actually can model for us, frankly, what that means, because it's not just that we're supposed to love others, but we're also called to love ourselves. And that is, I think, again, the central work of womanist theology. How do women of color learn to love themselves in a culture that just doesn't always love them the way they actually deserve?
I've been asked time and time again, why Beyonce? I believe Beyonce because she reminds us that sometimes you have to do your thing your way. You don't do it on demand. You don't do it for your oppressor. You don't sing when they want you to sing. You sing when God tells you to sing. Never give them your song.
For those in the bondage of classism, we need
freedom, freedom, I can move, freedom, I can move.
For those in the bondage of patriarchy, we need
freedom, freedom, I can move, freedom.
Now, there are some Christians who say, worship should just be worship. You know, don't draw on all these questions of justice. And I would just say, from the start of Scripture, all the way to the end, questions of worship and justice are completely and inextricably linked. There is no way to separate them out.
What do you want people to take away when they leave this Beyonce Mass?
First, I really hope it's not a flash in the pan. I think the real heart of this service is to say, we want to start a conversation. We want to start a conversation because Black women's voices are too often marginalized in every part of our lives, and they're too often marginalized in the church. And so our hope is to say, for those of you who don't know that church can be a place of refuge and life and hope, this is our moment to show you what that can be like. And to those of you who have experienced church as other, this is our moment to say, you know what? Let's issue a challenge to the wider church. And let's say we can actually live at a higher standard for ourselves. And that's what God expects of us. God is constantly asking us to hope for more for ourselves. There are people literally all over the country who I think are thirsty for this. The church does not do this enough. The church does not say, we can lean into these questions of justice. We can lean into them full-hearted, not afraid of what comes up. And we can do so in love and still have fun.
Mm-hmm. That's a rare message.
That is all possible. Mm. That is actually all possible. And so that's really our hope.
That's Pastor Jude Harmon, Director of Innovative Ministry at Grace Cathedral. And thanks to Audio Academy Fellows Zaina Nasr and Asal Hassanipour for recording the Mass audio for that piece.
Follow it, follow it, oh, 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 oh. The last one burning to the
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. In the mid-1800s, boomtown San Francisco was a city full of men. Women made up only 15% of the population, and though many ethnicities were flocking to the Golden State, still, white men were the ones cashing in on the boom. Then there was Mary Ellen Pleasant. She was one of the richest and most powerful people in the state, and she was a black woman. In fact, she was a freedom fighter, responsible for ending segregation on the city's streetcars a century before Rosa Parks. Pleasant died in 1904, but today she's barely remembered. The story that does get told is this mythologized tale about San Francisco's so-called voodoo queen. Well, KALW's Liza Veal and Olivia Cueva found out why this extraordinary woman fell from the city's graces and was left to haunt its history as the ghost of the Voodoo Queen.
The very last stop on a city tour called San Francisco Ghost Hunt brings you to the corner of Octavia and Bush Streets, where Mary Ellen Pleasant's mansion once stood.
Come in close, people, come close.
Jim Fassbinder guides the tour, and he talks fast. He tells a tale that he admits is not quite fact, not quite fiction. Says Pleasant had power over San Franciscans because she practiced, quote, voodoo. He says that some claim she was responsible for the death of four people, including her longtime business partner. Rumor has it, a servant found Pleasant
pulling apart the bones of his head and picking out bits of his brain.
As the story goes, she's haunted this corner ever since the day she died.
But Mary Ellen Pleasant's real story has been mangled by history. So what really happened?
It still is a mystery. Her life is still a mystery.
Cecile Bibbs has been studying Pleasant for over 20 years.
She wrote a book, produced films, and even wrote and performed a one-woman show all about Mary Ellen Pleasant.
She says part of the reason it's so hard to distinguish fact from fiction is because Pleasant herself never kept her story straight.
It was ingrained from the very beginning that survival meant you don't tell. You just keep secrets.
Bibb says by best accounts, Pleasant was born on a plantation in Georgia. But once she got her freedom as a young girl, she began falsifying her identity. Since slavery was still legal in much of the country, she needed to protect herself from law enforcement.
If they decided she was an escaped slave and she had no freedom papers, they could just arrest her off the streets and back into slavery.
Her skin was fair enough to pass, so when she docked in San Francisco in 1852, she arrived as a white woman.
Pleasant was ambitious. She stepped onto the muddy, smelly Embarcadero wearing a matching black dress and bonnet and immediately saw her business opportunity.
Young men's boarding houses.
Most men, from broke gold miners to rich politicians, lived in these crowded flop houses.
Pleasant decided to build luxurious boarding houses for high society men. Think extravagant balls and elegant banquets.
She had several boarding houses, made other financial investments, and by 1865, she had amassed $1 million fortune.
She ended up having the most exclusive boarding house in San Francisco.
And that's how she got access to the elite inner circles in the city. Even the governor lived there. He took his oath of office in her boarding house on Washington Street.
She knew how to create loyalty in these men.
A lot of people say, she used blackmail. Well, she did use a kind of blackmail at times, but that wasn't the reason. That wasn't the source of her power. The source of her power was gratitude.
But the whole time she was becoming an influential figure in the city, she was living as a kind of double agent. While most of San Francisco knew her as white, the black community knew that she was black and fighting for abolition.
She was a major link in the Underground Railroad, a funder of slave revolts across the country, and a pillar of the burgeoning black community in the city.
And all that African Americans knew was if they needed something, they would go to her, and somehow she would use her influence and they would get it. And so they called her the Black City Hall.
Pleasant got them housing, jobs, loans. She got legal charges dropped. She made it popular for high society to hire black people. She was determined to make it big and bring her people with her.
Then in 1865, slavery was finally abolished everywhere in the states. So Pleasant decided it was safe to stop passing as a white woman. For the first time, she checked the box marked black on the census. This is Bibbs reading from Pleasant's unpublished memoir.
My cause was the cause of freedom and equality for myself and for my people, and I'd rather be a corpse than a coward.
But there were consequences for fighting white supremacy. In the late 1800s, white San Francisco began to see her not as an insider, but as a villain.
The time when horrible things began to happen for African Americans.
To give some context, the U.S. was struggling to reconstruct itself post-slavery and had fallen into a Great Depression.
You have to look at the times. It was a backlash time.
Newly freed slaves were the ones scapegoated for the downturn. Politicians in favor of civil rights were now being replaced by segregationists.
Mary Ellen Pleasant became a cautionary tale for the country. This is what happens when you let a black woman get too powerful.
Rumors filled the papers.
You can find all kinds of accusations in the press.
That's Lynn Hudson. She also wrote a book about Pleasant. She says the press tried to cut her down to size by giving her the nickname Mammy.
The big, round, smiling black woman with a kerchief on her head, and she's so happy to be a slave. That's the stereotype, right?
Some reporters were mocking Pleasant by portraying her as harmless and subservient. But at the very same time, others would paint her as a powerful witch.
She's a woman with wonderful persuasive powers and a very hypnotic influence over weaker members of her own sex.
This was a time period when reporters played fast and loose with facts, and there were no repercussions. They spread rumors that she was a madam.
That she stole white people's money.
Even that she stole babies and sold them on the black market.
She was accused of putting a spell on a senator, sprinkling love potion on his undergarments.
The papers really fixated on Pleasant's voodoo practice.
Because here's the thing, according to Bibbs, she did practice voodoo, or rather voodoon, not the witchy, jinxy, magic stereotype you might be thinking of, but the Haitian religion her mother and grandmother passed down to her.
She was trained as a voodoon priestess, a role which tasked her with protecting and serving her community, the black community of San Francisco.
And the press ran with it. A voodoo queen, the perfect tabloid spectacle.
But Pleasant never cowered from the press or anyone else. She mocked the negative media attention and even played into it, like carrying around a crystal ball as a prop. She wrote in her unpublished memoir,
"Them newspapers, they can say what they want about me. When I'm in a fight, any byplay doesn't faze me."
Eventually, the San Francisco Chronicle, after smearing her for decades, admitted some admiration for her.
In her whole 38 years of residence in California, she has laughed at courts, disobeyed the orders of judges, and has escaped somehow from every tight corner in which she has been placed.
So she carried on, now known as the Voodoo Queen, until the day she died, in 1904, from heart failure.
Her whole life, Mary Ellen Pleasant was fugitive just by virtue of her skin color.
And wicked just by virtue of her gender. But Bibbs won't let that be her legacy.
If you look at Pleasant, you look at a person all alone, brought out of slavery, put into indenture, and how this person rallied every time, you know, came to the top of everything. It's just mind-blowing.
And maybe Pleasant liked the fight. Maybe it's the very thing that spurred her on. Here she is in her own words, read aloud by Bibbs.
"Now, if I'm dead, all right then. But as long as I'm living, I'm gonna fight. And I'm gonna fight to win. And I don't want to be carried up to victory on flowery beds of ease either. I like to go through bloody scenes."
For Cross Currents, I'm Olivia Cueva.
And I'm Liza Veal.
And that's our show. Today's Cross Currents team includes Marissa Ortega-Welch, Lisa Morehouse, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Christine Nguyen, Truk Nguyen, Lilia Vega, and Josh Wilson. Our engineers are Jackie Sajiko, Gabe Graben, and James Rollins. The line producer is Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by Smiles. The San Francisco band performs tomorrow night at the Hemlock Tavern. Show starts at 8:30. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.